Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Hello, hello. Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. I am so excited that you're here. Today, I have an amazing guest, one of my mentors, and he is just taking up space in this world and making his voice heard and creating space to change things for the better. And I really admire that, and I always have. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Howard Wright. Now, he is the CEO and president of C360. Now, this is like a tech and sports company. It is perfect for him. He's had a 25-year career in telecommunications, media, and sports technology, and really is driving his unwavering dedication to changing the way sports fans experience their favorite athletes and teams in this new immersive media economy. So, Howard has a really long list of receipts, and they're super impressive. So I'm just going to go through a few of those today so that we can just ground ourselves in, where he's coming from and the perspective that he brings that is so rich. So prior to C360, Howard was responsible for strengthening Intel's presence as a sports technology company and for developing new business opportunities related to the immersive experiences enabled by the Intel Sports Group. He spent 14 years at Qualcomm, where he was the Senior Vice President of Global Business Development, and that is where I first met Howard when I worked there. Howard has a bachelor's in qualitative economics from Stanford, where he also played collegiate basketball. And so after he earned his degree, he went on to become a professional basketball player in the NBA, where he played for the Dallas Mavericks, the Orlando Magic, and the Atlanta Hawks. So as you can guess, Howard is really, really tall. Howard was inducted into the Stanford Athletic Hall of Fame in 2001, and Howard is active on several national charitable boards, including serving as chairman of the Pro Kids Golf Academy and Learning Center. Please join me in welcoming Howard Wright to the Inclusion First Podcast. Hi, Howard. Thank you so much for being here on the Inclusion First Podcast. Welcome. How are you doing today?
I am fantastic, Sawyer. How are you?
I'm really good. So I'm so excited that you're here to have this conversation with me. And I would love to start by just talking about why you said yes and why you think it's important to have these kinds of conversations.
First reason is because it's you. And I don't think you've ever asked me to do anything and I haven't said yes. Secondly, and equally important, it's we are overdue for long-term, long-form adult conversations with peers and friends and allies. The only way we get through this is with confronting some of the things that have been left in closets, confronting some of the ideas that don't exactly mesh with mine, is to increase our empathy on each side. These voices from the center left, from the center right, of all colors, of all creeds, they're necessary now more than ever. And I tell you why, Sawyer. This year of 2020, the year of COVID, the year of Ahmaud Arbery, the year of George Floyd, forced us to sit and watch on national TV and cable TV every single night the whispers, the inclinations of what African Americans have been telling majority white America for years and years, that there's a two caste and that there is a two different criminal justice systems that exist in our world. And it materializes its way through legislative, executive branches, judicial branches, into our local government, into our local sheriff, police departments. It is America is long overdue for this conversation about race and the reckoning with race and racism. And now we're here. We're confronting it. What are we going to do as allies? Are we going to mute ourselves? Are we going to speak calmly with some intelligence to bring others into the tent so that we become a more perfect union? Because if not, the alternative is the disconnect that happened in D.C. It's the riots in the streets all over the country. It's the lunatics like Kyle Rittenhouse that are taking weapons upon themselves and trying to police a different state that they don't live in. Although this looks scary to have these adult conversations, the alternative is infinitely worse if we don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, we're primed for this. To your earlier point, seeing these atrocities happen and having just the pulse on that, like, opened up eyes in ways that I haven't seen them open before. Not just eyes, but hearts also. And so we have these people who are reaching out, wanting to help, wanting to learn more, wanting to do more, and not really having a space or not knowing how. And so that's one of the reasons why I want to have these conversations, so that we can show people, what does it look like to be an activist in your everyday life? What are these small, medium, large steps that you can take? How can it become something easy and accessible for you to do? So thank you, Howard, for giving us a little insight into your experiences. And the first question that I want to ask you is, what does it mean to you to be an activist in 2021?
To be an activist is to participate in this contact sport that we are in. One, you must educate yourself. We must educate ourselves. Education is not social media, is not one of the talking heads on Fox, CNN, or MSNBC. Education is reading 40 pages, 80 pages of filings, of briefs, of new legislation, understanding it for yourself. The lazy path through all of this, Sawyer, is folks seeing a talking point or two or four that they like from their nightly anchor and regurgitating that on social media and acting like they are some now political scientists. You have to do the required reading behind the required reading to have a point of view that I will value your opinion. I might not agree with your opinion, but if your only news source is a social media feed or one of the cable news networks, we can't have a holistic adult long form conversation. That's not worth my time because you haven't put in the proper work to do that. I go way back to my days in college when freshman year, political science and civics, there's required reading every year before you can actually voice your opinion in the class or have a cogent conversation or debate with classmates or teachers. I think we, as this new kind of bifurcated America, we are not doing the required reading. And to those folks, I simply don't value their opinion as much as those that are of us that are trying to lean in to actually do something and learn.
So for people who take that step and they're like, all right, I'm going to go do some research, and they end up in some crazy rabbit hole and think that that's the truth. Like, how do we, how do we help people to find the right source? It's not just like actual real sources versus the craziness that's so easy for people to get to and is actually being pushed in a lot of faces right now, right? So, I mean, I have friends who you're like, where did you hear that madness? And they're grown up, adult, regular people. And it's madness.
So I think, Sawyer, you and I possibly underestimate how powerful the medium is, which is cable news.
Hmm.
Let's call it exactly what it is. Disinformation for profit.
Yeah.
I don't care if you vote right. I don't care if you vote left. If you're a centrist, if you watch one of those programs over and over again, you will become biased. You'll become affected. Your IQ will go down, not up. So the political scientist versus somebody that's writing an op-ed, the PhDs
right.
and authors, case studies from world-class universities, those are the things that I try to gravitate towards and I try to study. An opinion piece from somebody that happens to have the same hue as me does not make it fact. It makes it a really eloquent opinion of somebody I might like, but that's not fact. The historical context from the day that I came into this earth, everything that has happened to folks of African-American descent since 1619 in this country to this day, you need to look at it through the lens of the totality.
Hmm.
Folks tend to not want to do the required reading of critical race theory and just attribute George Floyd's death to the fact that he had an enlarged heart or that he had narcotics in his system. That is such a pitiful, lazy excuse that I think puts the burden and a higher responsibility requirement to like-minded folks like me and you and others that we know that are some form of educated, some form of job in corporate America and want to use their platform for good. Again, I don't have to vote who they vote for. They don't have to send a check to the charities that I send a check to. But we have to rise up above this cesspool of lazy disinformation that is the common denominator that brings folks down.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love this idea of, you know, who, like, just being critical about where you're getting your information and this yeah. idea of opinion versus someone who has studied, has some kind of credential in the space versus not, right? So I think that's a nice barometer, really simple test.
Everybody is entitled to their opinion. Everybody is not entitled to their own set of facts. And our processors in our own brains should be able to disseminate and process that information for the good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So speaking of good, Howard, I want to talk a little bit about what good you're doing in this world and what activism looks like for you day to day. What are some of the things? I know there's a lot. There's a lot of things that you're doing between how you're raising your family to the work that you're doing in your community, to the work that you're doing as a CEO and beyond. Pick a couple and just share some insights for us on how that looks and how accessible that can be.
Sure, Carrie. I don't want to get overly emotional or spiritual, but I will share this, which is when we were together at Qualcomm, I knew the role that I had in terms of one of the highest ranking African Americans at Qualcomm. I took that role seriously, even though I did not take myself seriously. When we went to Intel and the change that we were trying to affect in corporate America and Silicon Valley with respect to diversity and inclusion. Again, I took the title very seriously. I did not take my participation very seriously, if you catch my meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It is maybe these last several years, and especially this year of COVID, where we sat home, you try to bubble your family, try to protect your family. Last year of any year in my 53 years on Earth, I recognized, Sawyer, that the generation of rights that came before me are watching me every day.
Hmm.
And that I take very seriously. The generations of rights that are here now that are my kids, I know they're watching me every day because they barge into my office and they interrupt business calls and such. And that's easy to pay homage to them and pay it forward to them. What is the harder trick is to try to repay this solemn debt that will never, ever be able to repay. My father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents who suffered a million little indignities mm-hmm. to get into the place where I could go to a decent school and, you know, get to a decent multinational company in corporate America. It is really the culmination of those two things. Having my first son 2 months ago after having three beautiful daughters.
Love it.
The responsibility of the platform that I have is not mine to tell silly jokes about nonsensical things. It's to draw attention and draw light to those who are following me that are interested in my point of view as to why I have this point of view. So a lot of folks that I see on social media right now, all you see or hear is the rage. Mm-hmm. Nobody talks about the reasoning behind the rage. I have righteous indignation and enormous rage about a lot of things that are going on in our country right now. I try to put it in a plain English way so that somebody can draw context to not this one individual victim of police brutality, but draw that line from, you know, George Floyd all the way back to Emmett Till, and how the real tapestry of American culture and American history is not taught. It is only picked through in terms of the most, it's romanticized in a way that always makes America look like being on the side of right. James Baldwin always says, I can criticize America because I love her so. That's why we continue to seek a higher form of justice, a higher form of equality, a higher form of all of our lives matter, and inclusive in that is Black Lives Matter.
Yes, yes. So do you see yourself as an activist? I feel like a lot of people are like, I'm not an activist because I don't X, Y, Z. I'm not in the streets. I'm not on a podcast. Like, do you see yourself as an activist, Howard?
I would like to think so. And I hope others would consider me so, to put me in the same sentence or the same descriptor or the same categories of some of my heroes, both heroes that have long since passed, heroes that are here that I've never met, and heroes that, you know, I've been on podcast or, you know, marched with together. The activism is a daunting task, is an additional burden, it's additional, you know, weights on the bench press to lift every single day. And I probably by myself could not do that, but I do have a reservoir of infinite faith, of infinite strength to draw from ancestors, again, who are not here. The challenge is not to be perfect every day. The challenge is to advocate for someone that does not look like you, does not speak like you, does not live where you live, but can make this world a better place every day. I think a lot of folks tap out on that because they don't want to, it's a mythical goal to chase. Mm-hmm. But the ideal is, Carrie, that I can advocate for the LGBT community, even though I'm a flaming heterosexual. I can advocate for women's rights, even though I'm male. That I can advocate for a group and be an ally to a group that I don't represent. That's where I think a lot of folks succeed and far too many folks fail. If it's not their group, their species, their hair color, their hue, they have no empathy for the other. This is, I think, a shortcoming for many of us. I'm trying every day to get better. Some days it's exhausting. Other days it makes sense in that I am a son of a father who basically was born into abject poverty, was a good enough football player to change the trajectory of every right that came after him. Mm. So basically son of a grandson of a sharecropper. And now me and my brothers and sisters and now my children have gone to world-class universities. There's no accident in that. There's a responsibility in that. I would be immodest beyond belief to say that I've done this by myself. I've done this fueled by wishes, desires, and prayers from those who came before me.
Thank you for sharing that. Can you talk about where you see activism showing up the most in your life? Is it at home? Is it in the community? Is it in your role as a leader and as a CEO?
I see it online in adult platforms. This is an adult platform. Unfortunately, Twitter has devolved into kind of madness. Facebook is just people barking at each other. Intellectual conversations, symposiums. That's where I find that I'm actually learning the most, and hopefully I'm sharing the most. The likelihood of somebody just finding a random tweet from me and saying, yes, I agree with everything this person says is zero. I voted right on a lot of issues. I voted left on a lot of issues. I am by nature probably a centrist and will form my own opinion. I don't need a party or a candidate up ballot or down ballot to tell me how I think or feel about any one of these issues. But more specifically, back to the point, Kerry, is the responsibility to put your thoughts, your full thoughts out there. That requires more than 140 characters. Mm-hmm. That requires op-ed. That requires somebody or a peer to ask, okay, how much are you donating to this cause that you believe? How many op-eds are you writing to the editors? How many dollars are you sending to organizations that advocate for your beliefs? Not how much money are you sending to a Democrat PAC or a Republican PAC? How much are you affecting grassroots, local, statewide, and then, you know, national politics to represent you? Are you just the dog that's barking at the parked car? Or are you using your time, energy, and intellect to promote things that you actually believe in? That's a balance, because sometimes the rage that I talked about can come out when you see something like the January 6th and the threat on our democracy and the threat on the lives of the members of Congress. I believe it's now for cooler, educated heads to enunciate their positions and try to get to a center majority to go forward with actual progress in the country.
So for those people who want to take those steps but don't know how yet, like, what advice do you give to someone who wants to figure out how to enter the fray, how to enter the conversation in a way that's going to be meaningful and impactful and help to move us in a direction that we want to go?
I have a 30-day challenge for anybody that's interested.
Oh, snap. Let's hear it.
First of all, turn your social media off and don't watch any cable news for 30 days. Second is find podcasts, find authors, find political scientists and PhDs, not opinionists. Find folks that have studied this in some of the most prestigious universities in the world. Read their books, listen to their podcast, sift through some of the classics, also listen to some of the new classics that are out there right now. I think we're intentional, or at least try to be intentional with what we put in our body, Sawyer, and how many steps did I get today, and what did I eat, and the carb load and the sugar and everything. We are not intentional with what we put in our mind. And I think I'm trying to get better. So I'm getting worse on like the food because we were stuck in the house. But I feel like I'm getting better with what I put in my mind. And it's reading from authors that are not just my favorites, although I reread Baldwin, although I reread Coates and Michelle Alexander and others. I'm trying to find like-minded individuals from Latinx, from Jewish community, from the LGBT community, and understand the common plight that we're overcoming, and also read from majority white males. I know that they must feel like they are being threatened by the browning of the United States, and that something is going to get taken away from them. Even the way we communicate, we have to do it in a disarming way so that we're invited into the room to have a thoughtful conversation. Me screaming from the outside of some building that I'm not invited to doesn't make sense. A group of knuckleheads screaming at a building where me, you, and some of our friends are will actually have no effect either. There is power in the center, and the responsibility, again, is to educate ourselves, do the damn required reading, or shut the hell up.
Yeah, and I think today it's so much easier to do that reading, to do that research. There's so many different ways. Like, even if you don't read, you can listen. Even if you don't want to listen, you can watch. I took an amazing class on anti-racism and storytelling to learn about both of those things. And it's totally informal. Like, there's not like a lesson plan. It was like exploring your own stories and speaking and performing and all these things. So whatever your flavor is, you can find a way to dive in and start to learn and start to expand your circle. And this, it was through the Boulder Story Slam in Colorado, and they did a really beautiful job of curating a group of brown people and not brown people who wanted to come together and learn about each other's experiences. And so, I mean, it was an incredible experience for sure. But there's just so much variety. Like, you really have no excuse. If you legitimately and earnestly want to jump in, there's a million different ways that you can do that.
So, Carrie, I don't know if this happened to you. I'm guessing it has because you have the platform and you have the voice that you have. But it started February-ish of last of 2020. Mm-hmm. Black History Month, I get a lot of counterparts say, hey, could I talk to you about this? Or could you talk to my executive staff about this? Could you talk to my team about this? Could you talk to the four of us about this? Could you talk to the 44 of us? The gentleman Emmanuel Acho talks about this uncomfortable conversation with the black guy. Or with a black man. It's one, it's penetrating those walls and not being so militant as to scare the hell out of folks, but not being submissive in any way whatsoever. So from February of 2020 to this day, I get genuine, sincere request to have a conversation in a small group, medium-sized group, or a big group. And I always laugh and tease the folks who invited me as, I'm the one black guy that this person knows, and so I'm here.
You're the one.
But I'm also recognizing that in its form is advocacy. It's activity in terms of seeking change. And it's doing it with this decibel level in my voice. Mm-hmm. It's not screaming. It's not yelling. It's not beating my chest, because still there is this fear of a black man in America and in corporate America. There's the fear of African-American female in corporate America. And she's all the stereotypes that you either have been said to your face or behind your back. I think part of our responsibility is to calmly eviscerate some of those stereotypes and then to bring them back to required reading. And I will say that not all, but a vast number of folks that I've had conversations with, we followed up later, because I said, if you want to have one conversation about this one event that happened in this one city with this one corrupt cop, you're looking at it through a too narrow of a lens. Here's some reading, here's some documentaries, here's some reading, here's some podcasts, listen to those, and then let's get back together on the phone in 45 days or 60 days. Some folks don't do the required reading, and they basically self-select out of my I don't give a care, give a damn zone. Others, I have found, wait a second, not only do I feel like I'm sharing some things that I've never shared, but I'm learning more than I'm sharing, Carrie. And that is, I think, when the particles accelerate. And now I see the tension, the retrenchment as the why through the eyes of somebody else, as opposed to you and I have always been either the first African-American in the room or one of the few on the team in the boardroom or in the classroom. Trying to get a 360 degree view of this is hopefully making me a better citizen of this country that we love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just so eye-opening to understand even the questions that people have, because it's not just about the question. It's about the thing that drove the question, the larger things that they're trying to understand. It becomes really, really fascinating. I mean, you know, I love the questions, and that's one of the reasons why we're here, to understand what people are wrestling with and meet people where they are. And I think the important thing about what you said is that even these one-on-one conversations, we have no idea the ripple effect that happens from that, because people are always watching, people are always learning. Even if it doesn't sink in that moment, there's nothing to say that something that you said won't spark something 2 weeks later when they're with their family, at work, in an important place, that will then spark something in the people around them. And so we're these little lightning bolts that have these like delayed reactions potentially, but it's very powerful and very important.
It also is, I've been pretty much this size, 6'8", since I was 16, 17 years old. So very rarely does a sober person say something to me to my face.
Yeah.
Our job, I think, now is to empower others to be allies for our mission and for our cause, and for them to be able to autocorrect somebody at a restaurant, in an elevator, at a wine and cheese party, on why either what they said was racially insensitive, racially inaccurate, or just a flat-out racist comment. Mm-hmm. Now, what we have is this backlash and this retrenchment around the cancel culture. And it actually makes me giggle in a way that we are responsible for our words and our actions.
We are.
Somebody is watching us, listening to us, or recording us all day, every day. If I were to have caused irreparable harm to you or yours, I need to stand up and apologize for that and promise not to do it again and make it right. Mm-hmm. So the mythology of the cancel culture is that everybody has a platform and can be on any network or any social media all day, every day. Nobody can be canceled. The unwillingness to be held accountable for things that have happened in this lifetime and the, you know, since 1619, is historically inaccurate and it's racially insensitive. So that's why a longer form conversations, some publicly on formats like this, some quieter in a back room of a restaurant with a nice glass of wine or coffee. These conversations are long overdue. This is our reckoning with race in the United States, because the pathogen of racism and sexism have never been addressed.
Mm-hmm. No, I love everything that you're saying. And as we kind of wrap up this conversation, for you, what have you learned from like doing this work, and especially right now, like in 2020, 2021, like what have you learned that you really are going to take forward as we continue to like push and press towards the world that we want to live in?
A couple things, Carrie. The responsibility that we hold.
Hmm.
More folks are listening. More folks are paying attention than we think. It's not just your immediate circle. It's not even the secondary circle. It's this tertiary circle, adjacencies. We have to hit the right notes so that we continue to inform. Secondarily, I've learned that there's been some lunatics that have been closer to me than I would have ever thought. And some of these third rail issues get brought up, and I see how folks make a ignorant ass out of themselves. I'm talking about some lunatics on the left and some lunatics on the right, where basically I need not have them close to my thoughts. I certainly don't want them close to my family, and I don't want them close to my platform. So a handful of folks, small percentage, have jumped off of whatever semblance of sanity and civility that we try to hold ourselves to. And at first, I was shocked, and now I do not even write them a goodbye note. It is we're better off without them. The last thing is this a moment or is this a movement? Is this a moment that will never, somebody will talk about, yeah, there is a window of 97 days, of 180 days where folks tried to get together? Or is this more like Southern leadership, you know, Christian Leadership Council, that was a movement that is still being sustained today in some derivative? The challenge for you, the challenge for me, is to keep this as a movement and not just a moment. And that is what fuels my desire to have these conversations with you and to be challenged by others.
Yes, the movement versus the moment. I think it's important for everyone doing this work to understand that everyone is in a different place. And so even if you're saying the exact same thing over and over again, you're like, are we still here? There are people who are just getting to this moment where they can actually hear what you're saying. And there's a million people behind them who aren't even there yet. And so even the smallest thing matters. Even saying the same thing over and over again, it matters, because we have to get to everyone. We have to get to everyone. And there's so much work still to be done. So Howard, what, as we close, what words of encouragement do you have to other people doing this work to keep, just to keep going?
The responsibility is bigger than you. We are, I think of this as a relay. If there were generations before that carried that baton, that suffered, that toiled in the mud of this country that we love, and they saved what they could, and they got incrementally to the next level. Some of those, of their kids, went to college or got a decent job and were able to send their children to a decent college. Now that we're here, how dare you not take the baton and run as fast as you can? That is the challenge, because I owe something to you, Carrie, and you owe something to me, because we're going to keep hold each other accountable. Mm-hmm. What we owe to the generation that came before us, every decade was worse than it is now. Are we going to, several decades from now, say, you know what, there was a chance for us to really try to link arms and join with equal dignity and equal support on an equal, on a common mission, but we flubbed it up because I had to work this many hours and you had to go do this? Or do we seize this and weave this into part of our genetic responsibility, take this baton, run as fast as we can, and then I'm gonna hand it off to my children, and my children are a million times better than I ever aspire to be? That's the goal. It is, you are a link in this chain. We have been handed this baton now. Everybody thought, oh, this is this post-color, post-racism, Obama, yeah, color-free world that we live in. We saw in 16 that was absolutely not the case. It was the retrenchment to some of the Confederacy and some of the far-right neo-Nazi activity, Proud Boys, and a whole bunch of other cowards that are out there. Our responsibility is not just to John Lewis and Martin Luther King. It goes well back into the 1800s and the 1700s. You know, off topic a little bit, Carrie. An author is writing a book about our family, and he thinks that he has traced us all the way back to some of the original slaves, that their foot hit Jamestown, Virginia in 1619.
Wow, that's incredible.
When he told me that, and he's showed me all the genealogy and the ancestry, that just struck a nerve of, I stood up straighter. I know that I am here. We are in the generations of the one they couldn't kill. What are we going to do with our moment? What are we going to do with our time? That's my challenge that I say to myself in the mirror. And that's what I'll share with all of us and all of your listeners right now.
That's amazing, Howard. That last story just gave me chills. So powerful. Howard, thank you so much for being here and for sharing all of this with us. For people who want to know more about you and follow you and your work and your perspective, where can they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn, Howard Wright. I have on Instagram and Twitter. I have a different Instagram and Twitter for my business account and then my personal account. Although I'm the same person, I might say it with a little different vernacular or different enthusiasm. But I'm around. Come find me. Come help me become enlightened, more enlightened than I am.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to theinclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.